Okay, so our topic today, explore a bit through the day of kamma. And I thought I'd just begin with this morning, just a bit of background as to some historic views of what karma is, a little bit about sort of contemporary views, and also specifically, in my understanding anyway, what the Buddhist teachings are around it. And just to first mention that in the teachings from the Buddha in the Pali Canon, which is my basis of training, that the topics of kamma and rebirth are pretty much inextricably interwoven. You know, most Asian religions and philosophies at the time of the Buddha particularly assumed some sort of rebirth process, like over lifetimes, one lifetime to another lifetime, except for one. There was one religious tradition, if you could call it that, of hedonist materialists who didn't believe in rebirth. But it's pretty much just an assumed part of at that time particularly, of many of the Asian religions and philosophies. So my goal today isn't really necessarily to talk a whole lot about that process of rebirth from lifetime to lifetime, but just to know that that's the background in which the tradition evolves. And so there's an assumption of that in the Buddhist teachings from the Pali Canon. And kamma is a process that sort of almost a natural law that arises as a foundation or fundamental aspect of the teachings of the Buddha. Times there may be references to rebirth. There's a lot, you know, of the way that the teachings have come to the West. There's a lot of, you know, many of the Western practitioners of Buddhism and many of the Western teachings set the issue of rebirth aside, and that's fine for our purposes here. So I'm not trying to make a big argument in this situation, although my opinions are fairly clear on supporting that part of the Buddhist teaching as well. But that the teachings on kamma are applicable over a wide range and a broad range of philosophical basis. You know, the word kamma actually in the Buddhist tradition basically just means action. Or intention, or intentional action. And that we use the word pretty broadly in the West to mean not just action, but also result, action and result. So it's like, I'm just experiencing the kamma of something. We're using that word also to mean result. And in the Pali tradition, there's a bit of a differentiation there in that we use the word vipaka for result. So there's kamma and vipaka, action and result. Just to give a little bit of the definition around it. But back at the time of the Buddha, you know, it was a very rich time of spiritual exploration in many different schools of practice, religion. There were many different views of karma. As well, at that time, it wasn't just any kind of singular idea of what kamma, action, what it meant. And I'm certainly, I just want to qualify everything here, I'm not an expert in the historical traditions, you know, apologize if I misrepresent any tradition from that time. And it's even more complicated in the present moment because so many people have many different ideas of the effect of action in their lives. So this is just kind of my basic understanding, just to give a little bit of background as a starting off place for people to consider and to maybe see what your own assumptions are, what you've come into today with in terms of what you've heard, what you've incorporated, what you might believe as what Kama is all about. So there were, basically two major divisions in how people viewed action and causality at the time of the Buddha. One is that basically human action is ineffective. The experience, how we experience our lives, is either completely chaotic or completely deterministic. Now, this is sort of one set of views that result in the sense that human action is basically ineffective. So that, there was one small school of samanas, practitioners, that basically felt that the world, our experience, all of our actions was just an illusion. This isn't something that, has any real substance or real meaning. That it's all just kind of an illusory dream. And the people who held that particular viewpoint would basically just say that all my experience is just totally random, totally chaotic. Nothing makes any, logical sense. There's no order in the universe. This is just what's happening, and no sense in trying to do anything about it or figure it out or anything. It's just, you just live it because that's the way it is, and it's basically just a big philosophical dream. So, human action is ineffective in their minds, and kind of the opposite end of that same spectrum were people who kind of felt that everything was totally deterministic, that anything I do doesn't have any effect because there's a set of laws of the way the universe runs, and I'm kind of just a part and parcel of that order that I have no control over whatsoever. I'm just part of this big, cosmos, and maybe I don't understand it, but there's really nothing I can do about it, but it's got a fixed course. It's determined. Maybe some of those views might hold, like an all-powerful creator God that has set a certain agenda, and that's what we do, is we follow that agenda. There's a plan for us, and we just do it. And whatever if things aren't going well, that's it, I can't change it. So you can see in modern day, many people have different sort of spoken or unspoken internal philosophies that kind of mirror those, everything I experience is just due to chance, kind of, I don't really have much control over anything. It's all, random, chaotic. At least they act in that way, even if they don't overtly believe it. Or the opposite of like, oh, well, this is just the way I am. I can't do anything about it. I was born this way, or this is due to my past karma. This is my karma. You've all heard that before. It can't be changed. I can't change it. This is the way I am. So those are some of the kind of ways that you see these kinds of philosophies manifest in our own actions and experience. So that's one kind of broad division that you would see at the time of the Buddha. Another one would be that physical action is effective, but also in a fairly deterministic or linear kind of a way, a tit for tat kind of a way. And again, there are many different manifestations of it at the time of the Buddha, and even more so now, I would suspect, in Asian cultures, non-Buddhist Asian cultures. But that one that was one of them that was prevalent at the time was the practice of the Vedics, the Brahmin caste, the priests, who were sort of the holders of many of the spiritual traditions at that time. And that there was a sense, we were born into certain stations in life, castes, based on karma, based on past experience. and that there was a way to move through those, but generally in a very fixed and linear way, oftentimes in related to certain rituals that needed to be done, certain oftentimes with sacrifices. That's where you hear about things like the animal sacrifices and even human sacrifices. That was all pretty much mediated by the priestly caste, the Brahmin caste, and that certain ways of doing things, going through certain rituals, would result in certain effects that you would then receive the benefit of. So that was one sense that there is an effect of action, but in a very deterministic kind of a way. Another one was, at the time, a group of spiritual seekers called the Jains did have a more view that physical action is effective, but not the same way really that the Buddha taught, in that essentially almost all action that was done was harmful in a way, regardless of what the mental component was. So that what one wanted to do, basically one's hope in ending the cycle of rebirth and getting off the wheel of suffering was to restrict all of one's actions that might in any way whatsoever cause any harm, whether intentionally or not. So there were many religious kinds of practices that they would adopt to refrain from harming themselves, any creatures, and also the belief that austerities, and in a way, in some of the schools, that infliction of self pain, self torture was a way of cleansing the old karma, and that basically what we were trying to do is to have all of the old karma that we've accumulated in the past be burned off completely, so that there was no more karma left. We had to burn off all of our karma, and in the process, not create any new karma by causing any kind of difficulty or harm. So a very strong set of very austere religious practices evolved in that tradition with a very deterministic and linear kind of approach. So those are just some of the views, roughly speaking, some of the views that were being engaged with at the time of the Buddha. And he actually practiced to some extent in some of those before his enlightenment, trying out different kinds of austere practices, particularly to see how they would be effective in terms of his quest, his discovery, or his wish to discover an end to suffering, to dukkha. So to make a very long story, involved story, in a shortened up kind of a way, he, through his 6 years before, once he started practicing and before he realized his enlightenment, uncovered what he would have then started to refer to his teachings under mundane right view. Right view is the first factor of the Eightfold Path that the Buddha set out in the Four Noble Truths. Part of that teaching under right view is this process of cause and effect, kamma, and how he described it. And what he discovered, essentially, was that he was of the school that action does make a difference. What I do does make a difference. Any kind of action, and there's the three doors of action that people probably know, body, speech, and mind. So we have actions of our body, things that we do physically. Speech is another form of action. And the mental processes is a form of action as well. So whatever we do by body, speech, or mind does make a difference in my experience. He discovered that. And most importantly, in what set himself and his understanding apart from most, if not all, of the other practitioners at that time, was his discovery that mental intention, in Pali the word is jetana, but mental intention, whether it's skillful or unskillful, is the large determinant factor of how we will experience the results of actions, of body, speech, or mind. So that, you know, completely unconscious action with no intention doesn't necessarily have a personal karmic effect in the mind. So the classic example, you know, is say you're walking along a path and you step on a bug and you kill it, and you didn't know that that was happening. Some of the schools say at the time of the Buddha would say, oh, well, that's bad karma. You know, you're going to experience the results of that. But what the Buddha discovered was there's no intention to kill. Now, if your intention was when you see that bug right there that you want to kill it, and then you stomp on it and you kill it, then you've created an action with an intention in mind. And that will have some repercussions for you in the present and or down into the future of the effect that it actually has. So that was his... the major thrust of his discovery with right view and comma as part of that, and then sometimes the word comma is even translated, you'll see, as intention. Generally, I think it mostly refers in the teachings to intentional action, actions with an intention, skillful or unskillful. And that's the basis of how we experience much of our world. So, you know, his basic goal, and I think we can all relate to, you know, what is it that we're looking for in our lives is some sort of happiness. And most of what we do through body, speech, mind is geared towards finding some sort of satisfaction in life, seeking out a sense of ease and peace, satisfaction, whether it's through different experiences in the sense world, sense sphere, or pursuits of the mind, how we live our lives, we're geared towards finding happiness and ending suffering, ending dukkha. And so he, you know, with his wisdom, observed his life and how he had spent much of his life in that same pursuit that we're all involved with, and realized that you know, at some point, that what he was doing, the ways he was seeking that, was possibly giving short-term benefits, you know, finding short-term satisfaction within the realm of sensory experience, but that it always seemed to leave, you know, he was coming up short. You know, there wasn't a long-lasting sense of well-being, sense of peace that he was discovering. And when he realized that, you know, there were certain aspects of life that seemed inevitably unpleasant, difficult, like old age, sickness, death, that his motivation then turned towards the question, realizing at this point that there was a point to doing something, that what I do makes a difference, you know, my actions will make a difference. Then he turned towards, like, trying to understand, and he posed the question himself, what when I do it, will lead to my long-lasting sense of satisfaction, to my long-term happiness, not just short-term happiness, but how is it that I can live my life and direct my mind, direct my experience, that will lead to a long-term welfare and benefit for myself, as well as other beings. And that's when he started to really discover the path that he then taught for 45 years after his enlightenment. So with that basic framework, that understanding that what we do does make a difference, we do have an effect in our lives, he described essentially... four types of kama. This is would be called. Let me backtrack just a little bit. That kama, first of all, kama is one of the kind of the natural laws that the Buddha described, and is the most important one in terms of determining the quality of our experience. There are other natural laws. Kama isn't the only one. Laws of biology, laws of genetics, you know, that affect our, you know, what it is that we come into the world with. Natural laws like weather and you know, astronomy and different kinds of natural laws that have an effect in our lives. Even psychological laws, the laws of the mind, how the mind works. A lot of that in the Buddhist teachings comes out, and you see the Abhidhamma about different levels of conscious activity and those kinds of things. So those are also natural laws. Kamma is one of those laws, and is the primary one that determines how we experience life, how we experience the world. So back to the four types of kamma. There's bright kamma, dark kamma, mixed karma, and then the fourth kamma, kind of kamma, is the kamma that leads to the ending of kamma. But to spend a little bit of, just a few minutes kind of describing a little bit of those four kinds of kamma, that, you know, bright or positive or good kamma are those actions that we would make that are have what we would call good results, or skillful, positive, wholesome results that lead to happiness, less suffering in our lives. And that those are based in many different kinds of virtuous activity, but largely following things like what the Buddha talked about with the precepts: engaging in non-harming, not taking of life, not stealing, not engaging in sexual misconduct, taking advantage of other people, not engaging in lying, harsh speech, other unwholesome kind of courses of action. And that if we take on these kinds of precepts, other things like acts of generosity and kindness, the ways that we act in the world, that these will naturally have a bright result in our lives and in the world around us. It's just the way that the mind and the heart works, and we can all probably relate to that. I don't think there are probably too many people in this room who haven't experienced you know, the results of those kinds of, taking on those kinds of undertakings, the precepts, acts of generosity, acts of service, and see the effects, see the effects in our own lives. Basically, actions that are based in non-greed, non-hatred, non-delusion. Greed, hatred, and delusion being the three root causes of suffering in our life. So the dark kamma is pretty much just the opposite. It's that which we do, body, speech, and mind, that causes harm to ourselves and to other people. And would be, you know, like breaking those kinds of precepts, taking life, stealing, etc. Being acting in possessive, stingy ways, acting out of anger, acting out of delusion, confusion. In ways that cause harm, pain to ourselves and to others, and that the natural result of engaging in that kind of action is going to be one where we experience the fruits of that in unpleasant experience of our own. There's also a lot of mixed karma, the third kind of karma that happens in particularly our human lives. We do things with mixed motivations, sometimes good things mixed with maybe selfish things at the same time, or unskillful things with a good motivation, but also that are an intentional action that might cause some harm. You know, I was thinking, you know, somebody who's sees somebody, you know, who might be starving, you know, or hungry on the street, and they don't have much money either themselves, and so what they do is they go and steal a loaf of bread to give to that person who's hungry. Well, there's a mixed effect there. You're stealing, you're taking something from somebody without their permission and depriving them and causing them harm, and you're doing it to feed somebody, a good thing. So there's going to be a mixed result from that in your own life. Many examples of that kind, I think, that people can see, particularly on a mental level. So in the teachings, there's also what's called this fourth kind of kama, the kama which leads to the end of kama. And when we talk about the end of kama, in a sense, we're really talking about the Buddha's goal that he attained in his own lifetime and then described, which is the realization of nibbana, the realization of enlightenment, the ending of all suffering, and particularly the ending of the cycle of the endless cycles of rebirth, release from samsara, the round of birth and death, and that there is action that one can take, positive action that one can take towards that goal, towards the ending of kama. It's when intentional action that causes suffering, harm, and rebirth in a very broad sense, rebirth of pain, difficulty, rebirth of suffering, rebirth of sense of self, as well as rebirth over many lifetimes, that there is a directional path that we can steer ourselves along to help realize the ending of that kama, the complete ending of kama, and that's the Buddha's Noble Eightfold Path, which most of you are probably familiar with, which is the core, the essential part of this teachings. And then when the Eightfold Path is picked up and practiced and adopted with that intention to completely free oneself, then that has the potential for setting the stage for the disbanding of the whole karmic process, the ending of kama. So this is the kama, the action, that leads to the end of kama, the end of action. A couple of other points about the law of kama that I think are worth mentioning. And again, I can't believe how fast I'm going over this and how much territory we're covering in a very short period of time. But yeah, we could spend a few months doing this if we wanted to. But so just planting some seeds for thought and discussion here. But some other, I think, pertinent aspects just to keep in mind are that the process of kama and vipaka, action and result, are very, very complex. Some teachings you'll find tend to be pretty tit for tat. You know, you do this, then this is going to happen. You know, if you do this, then this is going to happen. And it's the Buddha's teachings are pretty clear that it's much, much more complex than that. There's, you know, a vast array of intentions and actions over many lifetimes that are constantly playing themselves out over time in different ways, and they're intersecting and interacting and counteracting and interfacing in ways that basically the Buddha said was incomprehensible to the human mind. He actually called it one of the imponderables, and that if you really tried to figure it out, your head would explode, in his words. So very, very complex way that it all plays out over time. And that you can't actually predict when the effects of a particular action might be felt. That some of the effects of a particular intentional action will be felt right here and right now. You know, if you're a kind of an astute person and you get caught in a moment of mindlessness and anger or greed or whatever, and you tell a lie, a blatant lie, then, you know, if you're pretty alert and with it, then you might realize it right away and experience the effects of that. Oh my God, I did it again. You know, kind of almost an immediate sense. If you're maybe not so attuned to the inner workings of your psyche, then it may be sometime later that you experience the effects of that in your heart. Or an action that is really, you know, causing somebody else some harm, you know, maybe expressing anger at somebody that causes them to feel very bad or hurt. You may not experience the effects of it until a few weeks later, or a few months later, or a few years later, or a few lifetimes later. That person comes back and having somehow remembered that event gives you a bit of a hard time as well to experience the results. So there's all sorts of ways and over long periods of time that kama plays itself out and that we experience in the results of our actions. It's not all right here and right now and can be quite complex in trying to parse it out. So those are just a few bits of the teachings that kind of set a base for the Buddhist teachings on kama. We'll be spending more time later today on some of the other aspects of it, but I thought I'd just take a few moments now for people to let it digest and come up with any questions that you might have coming into the day or from a few of these topics this morning. We maybe have a period of a half an hour here for some questions and answers.
You mentioned light, dark, mixed, and karma that ends all karma. Is there random karma?
I guess it kind of depends on what you mean by random action or random result. You know, by way of the definition, at least in the Buddhist sense of karma, there really isn't a random kind of effect that, you know, if we say something with intention, then, I mean, just intention, I don't know how you can't really even define it in terms of randomness or not randomness. It's just what that intention is in the mind to do something for good or to do something, you know, that's not so good. And that, again, the results aren't necessarily particularly deterministic, and we do have an effect in our lives of how we might experience the results of that karma, which we'll be getting into more so as well. And it may not be so, as I was just saying, you know, it's not so predictable. So I guess you could say that there is, you know, that karma is not particularly predictable on our human mind, except in global ways, like that, you know, generally speaking, actions with an unskillful intention will give unpleasant results. You know, there is that kind of linearity in a sense, but how it plays itself out is very unpredictable. I wouldn't say random, because there's many factors that come into being, into play, but it's very, very complex. Very complex and unpredictable, but not random.
I was just wondering the distinction between not intentional, but not conscious or a delusion. What's the distinction?
Excellent. Yep. All of these things I knew would start coming up, and I've got them. I've got some notes to talk about that later as well, too. But intention. It's very good to note that there's different levels of conscious awareness of our intentions. Intention behind an action may be conscious or it may be, you know, subconscious. There is still going to be an effect. Just because we're not aware of saying something with the intention to cause difficulty, you know, it's not like, okay, there's not like this conscious thought of, I'm going to really tell that person off because, you know, I'm angry and they shouldn't do this and I don't think, and I want to put them in their place. You know, a lot of times our anger response is just sort of pretty automatic and we're not thinking clearly. And so that the intention is pretty subconscious, but the intention is to do something to get rid of that pain in ourselves. And we think based on past habit that the way to do that is by harming somebody else, either maybe just verbally, you know, but causing difficulty, you know, putting them in their place. Or if we get them to stop doing what they're doing that's hurting me, then I won't be hurt anymore. And here's the way that I've learned in the past to do that by, you know, saying something angry back. Then there's a subconscious intention there. And you'll still feel an effect from that. May not be the same intensity of effect if you were to do it extremely consciously with a blatant, you know, malice that you could feel and recognize. It may not be as strong the effect in your heart later on, but there is still intention there. Yeah.
It seems like when the Buddha's phrase, because that happened, then this happened, always seems to, for me at least, carry with it a certain recognizable quality as to both aspects of what took place and what the result is, rather than some more cosmic process that maybe is from five lifetimes ago.
So you're say that again. Are you saying that
it seems as though when the phrase is used, because that happened, then this happened.
Mm-hmm.
That there is an understanding that one could recognize both qualities, that which happened and that which is the result.
Mm-hmm.
And it isn't, at least as it's used in that context, not so obscure.
Yes, it's very clear. And we'll talk a little bit about, you know, the effects of action over time and in the present moment. That's part of some later explorations, I think. But I think that as I experience it and understand it, the Buddha's teachings were both pointing to experience over many lifetimes and in this lifetime, that the experience of kamma and its results is both very noticeable right here and now in this present life, and both very noticeable over many, many lifetimes. That the teaching, I mean, it's a lot of what I think Ajahn Jeff, you know, has a very good word that he's coined for. He calls it scale invariance. That the same laws apply whether you're talking about on a small scale, like in the individual psyche of one human being, and how we experience the world and our lives right here and now, as well as on a very large cosmological, air quotes, kind of a level, vast levels of time, experience, and understanding, so that those same laws, the same law applies on both scales. And in fact, I think it's a really good point, because even, you know, with the idea of many lifetimes and how we live our experience and experience the results of our intentional actions, how that affects us over many lifetimes, the way that we understand it, the way that we work with it, the way that we realize how to do it right is within this human life, you know, within this, as the Buddha says, this fathom-long human body of body and mind. We can experience all of these teachings right here, right now, imminently. And they have an effect over vast, you know, times of space and time.
You talked about the physical speech and mindfulness. I think
body, speech, and mind,
and
the three doors.
Intention, just and subconscious. And I just wondered if there's a way to adjust intention before you move to an action by being aware that, for example, I'm getting angry, that physically I feel the hair on the back of my neck going up, and it maybe it's subconscious, but I know that I can feel the anger coming, and so I'm aware that my intentions may be skewed. They're getting skewed already, and I need to... Is there something in the practice that says, boy, you can intervene on some of your intention using those three pieces?
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, what you've just said in the form of a question is, you know, the crux of the Buddha's teaching in terms of action, in that... within the Noble Eightfold Path, particularly mind training, the development of mindfulness, clear comprehension, awareness. This is the thrust of our practice, is to develop these kinds of skills so that we see much more clearly how it is that we've been doing what we've been doing that's been getting us into this mess. And to learn different ways to change that. And that it's through the process of slowing down, becoming mindful, understanding what it is that we're doing, that we can change our intention. which would then precede the action and the way that we act it by body, speech, or mind. So mindfulness keeps us geared towards remembering what it is that we want to do. We want to speak in a skillful way, say. That's mindfulness keeps on, you know, the heat of the moment comes up. Mindfulness kicks in and says, okay, I don't want to, I've done this before. You know, I've been in these situations before, and oftentimes I've just created a bigger mess. I'm remembering through mindfulness that I don't want to do that this time. Let me be clear, see the effect of potentially what it is that I'm going to say, how I'm going to respond, clear comprehension, how this is going to affect my inner being and the beings around me. Remember a skill. How can I deal with this situation here in the present moment with a different intention? So you've already changed your intention to from one of getting rid of the immediate discomfort or pain by blasting somebody to, I want to do this skillfully in a way that's going to work over the long term, not just the short term. I don't want to get just the short term gratification of, you know, telling somebody off, you know, the release of the energy. I want to have a long-term strategy of something that will be effective, not only make me feel better, but change the dynamic. So you have that intention. That's a different intention. And then through skill, through practice, you learn how to say what it is that's going to be useful based on that intention. So mindfulness, clear comprehension, long-term goal of happiness rather than short-term goal of release of tension, and skillfulness that you've developed all come into play as part of this practice.
So my question is, if one holds a thought in the mind or a thought arises in the mind and they don't speak the thought, and they don't act on the thought, is there an effect that's attached to that outside of the not speaking, the not, and the other part of that is, would it make a difference if that thought arises and is allowed to just drift away, or if one entertains that thought for any length of time or repeatedly? That's it.
Yeah, very good question. And it's getting into the subtle layers of how the mind works. And sometimes the distinctions aren't always so clear about when thought arises and what it means in terms of the question you asked. Is it going to create some sort of effect or ripple, even though it's not spoken or acted upon? And there's, you know, thought itself, the way most people use it is that conceptual use of language. It's a verbal process that just happens up here. It doesn't come out in speech, but there's a verbal process. Words is for the most part what people consider when they think of as thought. And my experience is that sometimes thought, those words that come up in the mind, are part of the result of a process, so that you have an experience. Something comes into your experience, say through the visual field or some word that somebody says, or just a random memory popping up out of who knows who knows where our memories randomly pop up from. But and then a memory comes up, you know, an association, say, with something painful or difficult, just in this case. And then a thought arises with that, you know, a verbal thought that describes it or identifies that or has an image of it, maybe, you know, a thought that's not on a verbal level but more on an image level. And, you know, maybe it's a thought of harming a creature or somebody, a memory of that, or an association, or a lustful thought, or something like that that is related to past action, that is an experience coming up as a memory and a relational, you know, like a perception, kind of on the level of perception. And right in and of themselves, those kinds of thoughts don't have a karmic effect. They're the result of something from the past. There's that level of thought where one is experiencing something based on causes and conditions that were put into the mix in the past, experiencing a result. But then there's, you know, this split second, very split second moment where it can turn into a reaction, where it can, you know, an intention starts to arise to take action, even if it's just in the mind. Like the memory arises of an unpleasant experience, say from somebody, like say somebody walks into the room that caused you harm years ago, and all of a sudden you hadn't seen them in 3 years, and then that triggers that memory, and that memory comes up. And then in a split second, the impulse to get back in some way starts to arise, even if it's a non-conceptual impulse, you know, that, whew, you know, something happens in the mind. And then a thought arises of, how am I going to get back? There's a thought, how am I going to get back at this person? What can I do? You know, that thought arises. Then there's an intentional forward thrust of the mind that's going along in an unhealthy way. And that will have a result. That's a comma. That's action that will have a result. Now, if you don't act on it in terms of your speech or your action, if you don't hit them or say something nasty or whatever, then the effect is going to be a lot less when it's left just at the mental level. But there is going to be an effect, at least in a minimum, in the heart of your own heart, if there is that mental impulse as a reaction. So there's two levels of thought. There's that which is the result of past association, past action, and that which is taking the next step to intend, even just in the mind, to have an effect. But I think it's a really important point that, you know, we can't expect fast and immediate results of how our minds work. And that if we can restrain our actions and our speech from moving based on those kinds of intentions, mental impulses, we are way ahead of the game of most of the world. So it all starts just in terms of starting to see how this works and starting to make a difference in your life. It starts with the precepts of, you know, being a bit more restrained. And I think restraint is really a good word. We don't like that word so much these days, but sometimes just not hurting somebody by speech or action is a tremendous gift to the world and to ourselves.
Thank you. More and more I've been seeing the importance of intention and speech and action. And I also feel alongside that, whether it be considered determinism or past lifetimes, I'm not real clear, but I also feel like I'm kind of being guided to move towards this direction. And that feels really powerful, you know, and it feels like my heart wants to move in this direction. And some of it doesn't feel like it's a conscious part of me.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm hoping you can speak to that a bit.
So recognizing that there's more to our experience than just this one lifetime and the effects of possible having past existences and how they impact our present life. And is that what you're starting to?
I'm not sure. The jury's still out in my mind about it, yeah, whether there are past lifetimes mm-hmm. that are affecting this. But I'm really aware, alongside the intention and the speech, that there's some propelling force that wants my heart to open and wants me to be here.
Some greater force than...
It definitely feels that way. Yeah. And sometimes it can be frightening, and sometimes it feels like grace.
So I was saying earlier, you know, the recognition of, okay, we're moving into rebirth here. the recognition of the continuity of experience beyond one lifetime is a very potent motivator, I think, in practice. It provides a sense of urgency in a way, and the Buddha used that particular reflection, the way it's described in the teachings anyway, particularly on the night of his enlightenment, and where he, you know, they traditionally describe the three watches of the night that he went through in the night of his enlightenment. And the first period of that night was him, and he had developed some very strong abilities of the mind to see beyond the normal range of perception. So he was able to see past lives of his own, and to see many, 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 I can't say enough manys, past lives of how he had lived and what he had done, and the immensity of, on a very large scale, of the suffering that, as a human consciousness, you know, he had gone through, experienced. The second watch of the night, he also was able to see that on a broader level, in that other beings, he was able to see over many lifetimes being born and reborn based on their karma. Essentially, it was the discovery of that karmic process in the second watch of the night. And those two insights that he had formed, at least as I understand it and see it from the teaching, formed the basis for his, you know, the intense motivation to be free from that. You know, that possibly the suffering in one lifetime isn't enough to give one the sense of urgency and immensity of wanting to get off the cycle of doing this. You know, sort of like, I have been doing this since beginningless time, you know. Many descriptions in the teachings of, you know, the amount of tears that have been shed, you know, far exceeds the amount of water in the great oceans. You know, those kinds of descriptors, very, very powerful, very strong motivation for him to say, enough, you know, done this enough. So whether you can verify it, you know, in your own life, whether you, you know, I can't see past lives. I can't see the human, I can't see other beings being reborn according to the karma. That's not my, you know, I don't have that ability. But you can take it on conjecture or, you know, working hypothesis kind of a thing and say, well, what's the effect in my mind? You know, if I take this on as a possibility, you know, for me, I'm only speaking for myself. For me, the effect is, right, okay, no time to waste here, you know. So there's a practical usefulness in terms of bringing that into consideration amongst other, all sorts of other layers. But, yeah, just to be open to it. You don't have to adopt it as a belief or come to a conclusion, but just to bring it into conscious reflection. And see where it, you know, see where it takes you. Yeah, just to be open to, you know, the ramifications of maybe beyond this, you know, very narrow internal experience of me here now. Okay, well, maybe one more question here before we take a break. We'll have plenty of time for other questions too throughout the day. Last question for now.
The karmic flow over lifetimes and the ownership of intention and the karma, and the apparent conflict with the doctrine of no self. Could you explain?
Not in 2 minutes. Okay, not self in a nutshell. The classic question of if there is not self, or if there is no, the way the question is often phrased, if there is no self, then who is it that reaps the results of karma over lifetimes?
Yes.
Right. The Buddha was very smart. He didn't answer that question. He basically, you know, people would ask that question, you know, because he did teach a doctrine of not self. But basically, if you phrase the question in the way that I just did, you know, sort of like, well, if there is no self, then what is it that reaps the results of karma? If you ask the question in that way, then the Buddha basically didn't answer it, more or less implying, from what I understand, that the question itself supposes something that doesn't apply. You know, you're kind of in the same question, you're supposing something which could be described as a self that experiences the results of karma. So if you're saying, well, if there's no self, then what is it? Then just phrasing the question in that way, what is it, implies that there is an it. And basically the process of, and this is, yeah, I really get myself into trouble by trying to answer it in this way, but I will anyway, because I'm not as smart as the Buddha was. You know, basically, you know, it's just this constant process of action and result. You know, there is no owner, in a sense, in a solid, unchanging kind of a sense. There is an experience of feeling the result of past action. It's very real, our experience, throughout this lifetime and then through other lifetimes. Sometimes the best way to describe it is to just say, well, you know, I had an experience when I was like 7 years old, and I have a memory of that, and there's an effect in my mind based on that memory and in that intensity of the situation. Am I the same person that I was when I was 7 years old? How different am I? How many lifetimes have I lived in this one lifetime that I can see as kind of almost distinct, you know, distinct beings? It's just sort of how we categorize our experience and try and lump it and solidify it into a way that's understandable. But if we recognize that who we think we are is basically just a construct of pulling together a whole bunch of things like the body and the feelings and the perceptions and the memories and the projections and consciousness and all these things and trying to meld them into one thing that makes some sense as me, then we realize that there is no singular unchanging entity that is the experiencer or the owner of all of these actions and their results. You can see that in this lifetime, you know. How is your body different than when you were 7 years old? How are your thoughts different? How are your emotions different? Could you really call yourself the same person? Yet you still have a memory of the effect of something that was said or done, you know, that has an effect. So there's a continuity of awareness. There's a continuity of effect from things that have happened to us or things that we've done that we feel into the present and into the future. So there's this continuity, but there's no one particular being that's solid and unchanging that we can say that's who is experiencing that. Sometimes, whether it's in this lifetime or going from one lifetime to another, an analogy the Buddha used was you have a candle that's burning, right? You've got the candle itself and the wick and the flame, and that candle is burning down. And the candle's about to go out, the flame's about to go out because all the fuel has been spent, right? The candle, the wax is just about gone, so there's almost no fuel left. And so you can take another candle and you can light the first, you can light that new candle from the first one, from the flame. And then that other one goes out, but you've still got a flame burning. Now, can you say that that flame is the same as the flame that was burning on the first candle? It still looks the same. Well, the fuel continued. You continued to fuel it. And it's our underlying tendencies, our greed, our hatred, and our delusion that keeps going. That the momentum, the fuel is there feeding the flame from one moment to another, from one lifetime to another. It's that thrust of becoming based on greed, hatred, and delusion that keeps getting reborn.